from two guys with a better stance than Tony Batista. It's At the Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
We like the fact that we didn't have to give up or reallocate any of our positional strength to get the starters that we got. That being said, maybe there is something that shows up and it's like, wow, this is a real good opportunity. We'll look at it. But we're going to continue to look in all aspects. We'll see what happens.
It's At the Letters for Tuesday, December the 1st on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes and everywhere on the internet that you can find podcasts. Please like, share, favorite, and subscribe. Tell all your friends to listen. Tell everybody this is your destination for all of that hot, hot Blue Jays rumor, speculation, and analysis this offseason. My name is Arden Zwelling. I'm a staff writer for Sportsnet Magazine, and I'm joined as always by my co-host, baseball editor for Sportsnet.ca, Ben Nicholson-Smith. Ben, what's going on?
Not a whole lot. We're back talking J-Hap.
You were just saying, every week, a new pitcher, you know?
It's funny, and I would never have guessed. I don't think that we mentioned Hap's name. Have we mentioned J-Hap's name on At the Letters until this point?
I've mentioned it in 2 years.
Yeah.
He was really
off the radar. I didn't think of him as a potential addition for this team.
No, not at all. Let's save this analysis. We are, today, we're going to talk about just that. J-Hap is the Blue Jays' new $36 million man for 3 years. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about just how the Blue Jays' starting staff is shaping up. Talk a bit about the ongoing GM search for the Blue Jays. I'll talk a bit about what's left to do for this team, perhaps some additions in the bullpen, perhaps some guys the Blue Jays could target there. And very, very exciting, we're going to be joined by Ray Searidge, who is the pitching coach for the Pittsburgh Pirates, widely accredited with helping J-Hap kind of turn his life around. Basically, last year he arrived in Pittsburgh and, he was just kind of an unremarkable starter up to that point, with the Blue Jays and with the Mariners last year, and then arrived in Pittsburgh. And all of a sudden, he's a 1.85 ERA guy. And a lot of people credit Ray Searidge with, making some of those tweaks, making some of those adjustments that helped J-Hap get over that hump. We're going to talk to him all about it. Very exciting.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
So, let's talk about this J-Hap signing. I mean, were you, you indicated earlier, I mean, you were as surprised as I was that he was the guy.
Definitely. I didn't see this coming at all. I thought that, okay, they would probably go for a mid-tier type of starter, but I was thinking the tier above J-Hap, kind of the Samardzija, Weihan Chen, Mike Leake tier. And you know what? If you look at Weihan Chen and J-Hap, they're not so dissimilar from 2015. If you look at their 2015 numbers. Now, Chen has a better track record. Hap has a mixed track record, but he's been a solid pitcher. I mean, I think that as much as anyone was going to be a disappointment as compared to David Price, Hap is solid. He should be able to help any team win, and I expect him to do just that for Toronto next year.
I think the counter to that would be that Weihan Chen's been better in the AL East than J-Hap has been. You know, J-Hap's best success came in Pittsburgh. In the NL Central, facing a lot of lefties, getting to face the pitcher. You know, the National League just generally is a bit less offensively potent than the American League. When J-Hap was with the Toronto, with the Blue Jays, he was kind of hot and cold. He had his stretches, and he had some very good periods, but he also had some periods where, he wasn't getting deep into games and wasn't being efficient. Weihan Chen, a guy who, as I pull it up right now, 2014, 3.5 ERA, 2015, 3.34 ERA, pitching in the AL East.
Yeah, and that's why he'll earn twice as much or more, for sure. So the idea being, though, that, Hap, when he's going pretty well, he can be somewhat of an approximation of a solid, say, number three starter. And even when he's not going well, he can be a solid number five. So this way, the Blue Jays add some depth to their rotation. They don't give up prospects. They don't give up picks. It's not a particularly exciting signing. I mean, everyone's already seen J-Hap. I don't think that this is going to be heralded as the next great Blue Jays pitcher the way David Price was, and he certainly lived up to that. But at the same time, I guess it raises the question of whether you need an ace, because I think at this point it's very clear David Price is not coming back. So do you need an ace? And are the Blue Jays setting themselves up for trouble by not having an established ace in their rotation?
Yeah, we've talked a lot about that, about how, the Kansas City Royals, obviously things went pretty well for them without an ace, and they didn't have one until, I guess arguably Johnny Cueto, but he certainly didn't perform like one in Kansas City. Something that I can't believe I kind of overlooked was that the Blue Jays didn't have a lefty starter until J-Hap. And we never talked about, the Blue Jays need to get a lefty starter. We just talked about their need to get a starter. But like it makes a lot of sense to me that they would want to go get a left-hander. I thought maybe Scott Kazmir would be more of that guy for the Blue Jays. But, you know, I think that the Blue Jays' familiarity with J-Hap kind of says something. The fact that they had him in the system for 3 years, they know his arm. They know his medicals, like, really, really intuitively. You know, over those 3 years that they had him around, and they, you know, I feel like the Blue Jays maybe know some stuff that we don't know, that would, you know, we'll see what Scott Kazmir eventually gets. And maybe that was too much for them, or maybe, you know, they just have a little bit more faith in J-Hap going forward.
Yeah, exactly. It's a known commodity, which is at least something. I mean, they know what kind of guy he is. He knows what he's getting into as well, which is part of what drew him to Toronto. He was watching. He says he's a baseball fan. He was watching as the Blue Jays went on this incredible run.
Yeah.
So, you know, now at this point, I think we know what the rotation is going to look like, although they could technically add another starter. And Tony LaCava says they're still considering that. I don't get the sense that that's necessarily a front burner priority the way it was earlier this winter.
Well, because, you know, right now you have six guys without even getting to Sanchez or Osuna. If you wanted to talk about turning one of those guys into a starter, you got Marcus Stroman, Marco Estrada, J-Hap, R.A. Dickey, and then Chavez and Hutchison, who are probably just going to fight for that fifth spot in the rotation. As things stand now, who knows? Injuries happen. Who knows what's going to happen? You know, guys get moved, right? Like, who knows what's going to happen by spring training? But that's kind of how things stand right now. How do you feel about that group going forward? Do you feel, should the Blue Jays have confidence in that group, or should they still be looking to add to it?
I think both. I think that if they could add a starter, then Chavez opens the season as a long reliever, and then either you face an injury, or at that point you could option Hutchison and have him be some much needed depth at AAA, because they really don't have much of that either. If you look at how their upper minors pitching depth is shaping up at this point. But I think that they can get by with what they have. Absolutely. I think that would be a relatively solid rotation. You have some upside there in Stroman. You have some steadiness there in R.A. Dickey. And then of course Estrada, Hap, Chavez, that group. But I think, you know, you still want to look, you still want to see if there's something out there. But to me, the bullpen has to be a pretty high spot on the priority list as well, just because they need innings.
It's the point I was just going to make, is that, like, if you are going forward with this rotation, you better solidify that bullpen, because, you know, outside of, you know, Marco Estrada's shown he can go deep into games. Marcus Stroman, I mean, you know, what has he really shown? I mean, you've seen elite talent, but, you know, you just haven't. We don't really know, but at, you know, when he's at his best, he can be a guy who can go 7-8 innings. But from there, I mean, R.A. Dickey, J-Hap, Jesse Chavez, you know, Drew Hutchison, five and dive guys, kind of, right? Like, not guys that you're going to count on to consistently every time out be going 7-8 innings. You really need to shore up that bullpen if you're going to be going forward with these guys.
Dickey's the only one who's ever pitched more than 185 innings in a season. I mean, that's it's a high bar, but at the same time, some rotations have three or four guys who have done that. And the Blue Jays, entering last season, they had Dickey, they had Burley, they kind of had some sense of stability there, and they could build from that and go forward. But at this point, I think they need to add a couple arms to that bullpen. I think that, you know, you could look for a lot of different guys. You want to have, you know, you can kind of look at bullpens in so many different ways, right? But I think you want to have three or four guys who are really solid, guys that are going to be there your entire season. And I think you want to have a few spots that you're cycling guys through, you know, for performance or for injury. You option someone down. You want to have some flexibility there with those last few spots. I think the Blue Jays could add a lot more than what they currently have.
Absolutely. You know, R.A. Dickey's a guy who, you know, at his best is a guy who can go 9 innings for sure. But I think we saw John Gibbons kind of trend a bit more towards, let's get him out in the sixth. You know, let's not let him get through that third time through the order. Like, you know, let's get him out a bit earlier, and we'll see if that continues over into this year or not, or if, you know, they're going to lean on R.A. Dickey as an innings eater now that, you know, Mark Burley isn't around to do that anymore. We'll see. But, you know, you mentioned, you know, having that core group in the bullpen. If you do have Roberto Osuna, Aaron Sanchez, Brett Cecil, feel good about that. Those, you know, those are three pretty guys at the back end of the bullpen. I'd like to add, you know, another two, like a guy who can fill kind of that Mark Lowe role, you know, and be really consistent. And, you know, that guy might be out there on the free agent market.
He might be Mark Lowe.
He might be Mark Lowe. We'll see. You know, that would help. And then really, you really need a good lefty, I think. Because going forward with Brett Cecil is your only reliable lefty in the bullpen. You know, I'm not too, you know, I'd like to have another one. And I'm not sure that guy is going to be Aaron Loop. Aaron Loop's got to show us something.
Yeah.
So I'd go out and get, you know, a high upside lefty for that bullpen.
Yeah, it certainly wouldn't hurt. I wonder if Loop could bounce back. You know, with all the home run issues that he had, and clearly you don't want him facing righties. But if you use him in that specialist role, I wonder if he could have a bounce back year.
I wonder. Back to Hap. I think that, you know, what the Blue Jays are really banking on, and you know, I heard you were on with Jeff Blair this morning, and you mentioned, you know, Jay Hap did really well for himself, and he did, you know, $36 million for 3 years for Jay Hap. You know, like, that's in, you know, you can kind of look at it through a couple different prisms. You can look at it through, you know, all right, this is baseball. There's a ton of money being paid. $12 million isn't that remarkable anymore. But same time, Jay Hap got a 3 year guarantee for $36 million. He did well for himself. And what the Blue Jays are really paying for is 11 starts in Pittsburgh, where he was brilliant. 1.85 ERA. He had a bit more velocity. He was in the zone, striking a ton of guys out, not walking a lot of guys. I mean, he looked great. And the Blue Jays are kind of, that's what they're betting on, is that Jay Hap will be able to carry that forward into this year. Does that, I mean, is that worrying? Is it real, is what the Blue Jays need to figure out?
I mean, I don't think it's real. Yeah. I don't think it's real, but maybe it's somewhat sustainable.
Is it real enough to bring him down from a 4.5 ERA, right?
Yeah. I think, you know, if you look at, he really struggled, I think it was the first month of the 2014 season. And since then, he's been reasonably solid. So I think that you're looking at a guy who should be, I think, a reasonably good pitcher. And then you have the hint of upside with him having changed his arm slot, throwing a lot of fastballs, which seemed to work really well for him.
Yeah.
So, you know, you pair that with another good framing catcher, Russell Martin, a good defense behind him. I could see Jay Hap having a pretty good season, you know, an ERA around 4, maybe even under 4. I'm certainly not expecting him to go out there and put a 2 ERA up and strike out 10 per 9, but one thing I do think is sustainable about what Hap has done is limiting the walks. He's really shown improved command as the years have gone on, and I think that there's a real trend in that direction.
Like, if he could get deeper into ball games, that was kind of the big thing that stuck out to me from his time in Toronto, was like those like 3-inning, 4-inning outings, right? Where it's like, you know, it's the fourth and he's up to 85 pitches. You're like, Jesus, what happened? You know? So I think that efficiency is really big for him. I think the throwing, you know, more hard stuff is big for him, because he can command, I mean, his most commandable pitch is his fastball. So it makes sense to lean on that. And if he can do kind of be a Marco Estrada and have this just great pinpoint command and just put that fastball where it needs to be, just off the bat, you know, just off, just off the whatever. I mean, that's big for him. And if he can continue to do that, the other thing is, he moved for his main secondary pitch, he kind of moved away from using a sinker and moved to using more of a cutter. And so we'll see if that's something that he can continue to do at the Rogers Center, or if being in a hitter's environment is going to make him want to go back to that sinker, get more ground balls. So we saw, and, you know, what's scary, I think, for a lot of Blue Jays fans is then Seattle last year, which is not a great hitter's environment, Jay Hap got beat up and he didn't look great. And he had like a 4.64 ERA in his time in Seattle. I think that's worrying, is that, you know, is he going to revert to that, you know, now that he's out of the NL, away from, you know, facing the pitcher, this and that?
I think we're probably going to see ups and downs. I mean, having a guy like David Price is such a luxury, and it's understandable that a lot of Blue Jays fans want him back, but it's so rare to find guys that are actually, you know, consistency is such an overused word when it comes to these kinds of things, you know, because there's this idea that every single time out, they're throwing 7 innings and 7 strikeouts, 2 earned runs. Very few guys actually do that. And I wouldn't expect Jay Hap to do that. I would expect that he's going to have some good starts, some mediocre ones, almost in that Mark Burley mold, some rough ones. And in the balance, it's going to add up to, say, 175 innings of an ERA around league average. And I think that that's worth paying for, even if it's not particularly exciting.
It's worth $12 million these days.
Approximately, I mean. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Pretty much. You know, they're not even, and this year they're only paying him 10. They're not even really paying him to be like a 1.5 win guy, basically, is what they're paying him for.
Right. Brett Anderson got $10 million last year coming off an injury. I mean, yeah. $10 million doesn't get you much in the starting pitching market. You look at Scott Feldman, he's earning $10 million. It's just
Guthrie.
Yeah. These guys are not top of the rotation material. And there's some chance that a few years from now, some team is going to say, oh, Jay Hap's earning $13 million a season. That shows you that, you know, these deals don't often work out. But, you know, Hap has reliably been useful. It doesn't mean he's going to be dominant, but he's been useful. And that, there's a place for that on a big league roster.
3 years term isn't the scariest thing either. I mean, after this year, it's just 2. And that's an asset you can move, or an asset that you don't mind having to hang on to. Like, we're not talking about paying Ricky Romero for, you know, 3 more years or whatever, right? Like, it's you feel okay about it.
Right. They have also the best offense in baseball.
Yeah.
So I don't think that you necessarily need to have, hey, having the best pitching staff as well as the best offense would be great. But realistically, having a solid pitching staff can be enough to win a lot of games.
Absolutely. In the front office, changes afoot. We, you know, reports this week that the GM search has been narrowed down to two men. One of those men is currently the interim GM of the Toronto Blue Jays, Tony LaCava. Another is a close friend and confidant of Mark Shapiro's. His name's Ross Atkins, player personnel guy in Cleveland. It seems like it's down to those two guys. You know, without, I don't have any knowledge of the discussions or like what, you know, what's going on in that, you know, with that search, with the interview process, anything like that, just from a complete outsider's perspective, it would make sense to me to hire Ross Atkins because Tony LaCava is probably going to be okay stepping back into the assistant GM role. He's locked up for, you know, a long term. He got that big contract extension from Mark Shapiro. He's a Blue Jay. He wants to be a Blue Jay. He wants to see this through. So you might as well go get Ross Atkins and have both guys.
Yeah, I see the thinking there. I guess, would you have to make Ross Atkins the GM to bring him to Toronto?
I wonder.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
That is, yeah, that's the other thing, right? Could you bring him in as an assistant GM here?
Yeah, some kind of VP. There's so many different titles that you can pull from in baseball these days. I mean, I wonder if they really want Ross Atkins, and certainly Shapiro seems to like him, even just by virtue of the fact that he's a finalist for this GM job tells us something. But I wonder if there's a way to bring him in and still have LaCava be the GM.
Absolutely. The big thing with front office maneuvers between organizations is often they want guys to be getting promoted. You don't want those kind of vertical moves that you want, or horizontal moves. Well, you want promotion. So, you know, you would have to make the title something that is greater than what he's doing in Cleveland. But yeah, maybe you don't have to go as high as GM.
If there's one thing that baseball front offices are really, really good at, it's coming up with unnecessarily complicated titles. So I think they could come up with something.
It's BSing their way through problems.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, maybe that could be a start of, you know, building a Dodgers-esque, you know, front office where you have several guys who could be GMs in-house and you have several guys working together, you know, and you know, like, I was mentioning this at Pitch Talks in London, like, you know, like front office executives, like they don't get hurt, they don't slump, you know, so that's a pretty good bet. And it's a place where you can spend money. It's still kind of the Wild West in terms of what you spend and who you can bring in and how you put guys together. There's no, you know, there aren't, you don't hear about front office payroll parameters. So
that's for sure. Maybe we will at some point.
So, you know, why not? I mean, I feel like the more the better, as long as everybody gets along and everybody, you know, as long as there's cohesion, why not?
Yeah. And I think we all expected that Shapiro was eventually going to bring in some of his own people, and we haven't seen that yet. You know, Bud Black, who is someone that people talked about a lot. Yeah. Okay, he's in Los Angeles now with the Angels. The Indians haven't given up any of their front office people yet to the Blue Jays. So, you know, I don't know exactly where things are going to land as far as titles, but I wouldn't be surprised at all I would expect that Atkins is going to be part of this Blue Jays front office in some capacity.
Interesting clause in Bud Black's deal with the Angels. As reported by John Morosi, former guest on ATL, Bud Black's special assistant role with the Angels permits him to leave his contract early if he's offered an MLB managerial job. So that, I mean, you know, that lines up.
Right. Yeah. Right. For any opportunity. Black's going to be in demand. It's not just, you know, the funny thing is with so many of these guys, they're so well connected, like they're so entrenched in the game, and so they have opportunities, whether it's Toronto or Washington was after him, obviously that ship sailed, but there are going to be other teams that want Bud Black too.
Eric Wedge, another guy who gets mentioned a lot around Mark Shapiro, is a guy that he likes, who, you know, could be coming over to the Blue Jays. But you're right, you know, ever since when Mark Shapiro was brought in, we haven't heard too much about, you know, front office maneuverings, you know, he promoted, and I'm completely blanking on the name, the analytics guy.
Joe Sheehan,
right, promoted him. Other than that, we haven't really heard too much maneuvering in the Blue Jays front office.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I think that even the interview process has been pretty quiet. I mean, we didn't hear, presumably Ross Atkins has been interviewing with the Blue Jays. We didn't hear about that. You know, they've kept it pretty quiet, and presumably that's by design.
We heard they talked to Rene Francisco from the Royals. We heard that he was interviewed. But yeah, other than that, we haven't heard about who else they've been talking to even.
I would assume there were more candidates, but who knows?
One would. Just before we wrap up this segment, let's talk about what's left to do. We kind of got at it with the bullpen a bit. And I do think that's an area that the Blue Jays are going to focus on pretty heavily right now, and that, you know, if you do see I think the next transaction for the Blue Jays is likely to involve the bullpen, I would imagine. Do you think there are some guys out there on the market who, you know, are perhaps potential candidates for the Blue Jays to get?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think that, so they've been corresponding.
How'd you know? I was going to ask you that.
Yeah. I have a list here. So they've been talking to free agents a little bit more, and that's one way that you could, of course, address the bullpen. I think that's a very logical way, and we've seen so far free agency is great because you don't have to give anything up other than cash. But I think there's some other intriguing names out there. And I think, you know, going back to that point about options and having guys that you can cycle through, you look at what the Dodgers do, what the Rays do. I think that there's some validity to that. And I think that if you have guys with options, that gives you some flexibility. So guys like Rafael Martin with the Nationals had a great season. He has this amazing slider. You know, take a look at him. It doesn't have to be Storen and Papelbon, these big names. Aroldis Vizcaino with the Braves, he's arbitration eligible. The Braves are clearly going through a transitional period. Maybe Vizcaino is the kind of guy that you could get. Even Kevin Quackenbush with the San Diego Padres had a really good season. All these guys have options. I mean, you can look at them. They would be hard to get for those reasons. They're affordable, they're controllable, they're very effective, swing and miss stuff in all these cases. But it's probably worth taking a look just in case you can maybe tag them onto a deal, find a way to add them to a bullpen that really could use a couple reinforcements.
We were talking about this earlier, just between ourselves, about how, you know, there's so many guys out there and you don't necessarily hear about them. Like, you know, in the Toronto market, we know Brett Cecil is like really, really good and that he's unreal. But I feel like in other markets, they're not that aware of him because bullpen guys just don't get publicized as much. We were talking about, you know, seeing Texas in the playoffs and being like, oh my God, Sean Tolleson, Sam Dyson, sick, right? Like, but you don't have that much like awareness of these guys. So yeah, there's a ton of like quality relief arms out there that could probably be had.
And I think the standards are rising in bullpens in a lot of ways. I mean, it used to be pretty remarkable for lefties who were throwing over 90, or if a righty threw 95, oh my goodness, you know, this guy's like, now that's the norm almost. I mean, you need to have, it's really not that remarkable if like Liam Hendricks is throwing 95.
Yeah.
I don't think people beyond Toronto and maybe Oakland really know who Liam Hendricks is. He had an amazing year last year.
He did.
And you need to have guys like that to step into your bullpen in case of injury, in case of poor performance, you know, someone is on the DL for a couple of weeks, you need to have options. And I think that, you know, in trade, that could be one way. And maybe, you know, with this week's non-tender deadline coming up, this is a period when you typically see a lot of activity. I wonder if maybe some of those trade talks that are going to be starting to build momentum in the next 10 days or so, I wonder if that's a time for the Blue Jays to start looking at their bullpen in that way.
It's interesting because, and we've, you know, kind of heard some of the rumors this week that, you know, the Blue Jays are talking to guys with closing experience who are out there. And so, you know, that like immediately, you know, Ryan Madsen comes to mind, Joaquin Soria comes to mind, like those kind of guys. I don't know if the Blue Jays are going to want to, you know, pay the freight that it's like, you're not going to get those guys on 1 year deals. I mean, you're going to have to give them 2-3 years. I don't know if that's the approach they want to take or if they want to go generally, and you know, Alex Anthopoulos isn't here anymore, but generally with Alex, it's been, let's get, you know, very short-term deals for relievers. You don't pay for bullpen pieces. You can, you know, try to find guys in-house, or you can, you know, try to get guys on kind of one-year deals and things like that. So we'll see if that continues or if they're going to give Joaquin Soria 3 years. Who knows?
Yeah, and we don't know. I would be surprised as well. I think that at least what they can do now is touch base with those guys and say, hey, we have some interest in, you know, bolstering a bullpen, and if circumstances change, let us know, kind of keep us posted, that kind of thing. It doesn't mean they're going to be the team pushing hard on Darren O'Day. I really don't think that's going to happen, but it's still a way for them to keep tabs on the free agent market.
What's Darren O'Day going to get? Like 3-4 years?
Yeah, I think so.
Over 20, probably like 25, 30?
Yeah, I would think 25, 30.
Around there or more?
Maybe a little more.
It's a lot of money for a relief arm.
He's a good reliever. Like, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, he's the best reliever out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's
relievers can be so, you know, like combustible, you know what I mean? Like, it's funny, you know, Aaron Loop was great for the Blue Jays for 2 years. And then this year he was not great.
Right.
It's kind of wild to, you know, to be able to make that kind of an investment in a relief pitcher, I think.
And it's all about timing. I mean, if you're a reliever and you hit free agency after a down year, like take Ryan Madsen. So he signed a minor league deal this time last year.
Yeah.
And when he signs this year, I expect it to be multiple years. Yeah. So he's the same pitcher. He's just proven himself. He had one really good year, but it can vary so much. I mean, you can be a minor league deal one guy, and like Zach Duke last year, he was minor league deal and then 3-year deal.
Right. It's wild.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of money, especially to pay for a guy who's only going to pitch 70 innings for you.
Yep.
You know, it's crazy.
It's nuts. And so that's, you know, that's a tough assignment for any front office to try to find the next bullpen bargain, the next breakout candidate. But I mean, that's that's a real distinguishing factor between good teams and bad.
That's why I kind of get the teams that want to find their bullpen arms from within, because at least you know these guys. You know their medicals, you know what they have, and you know their potential and what kind of tweaks you can make with them and things like that. Like, that's why I kind of, I understand that approach, and that's the one that makes the most sense to me, because if I have only so many dollars to spend, and you know, I'm the Blue Jays and I need to, you know, spend free agent dollars on something, I'd rather get like a really strong utility middle infielder right now.
Yep.
You know, I'd rather get like a really, you know, a better backup catcher than Josh Toley if I'm spending my money.
Yeah. No, that's completely fair. And I think that in other circumstances, if you were looking at a organization that had more depth in the upper minors, I think that would be an approach worth taking. But I'm not seeing, you know, and I may well just be blind to these guys, but I'm not seeing the breakout candidates within the Blue Jays upper minors, whether it's AAA or AA, guys who are poised to take that next step.
No, you're kind of, you'd be counting on like Steve Delabar, you know, rediscovering it, or like Chad Jenkins taking a step. Guys,
we
like
know
that.
Who Chad Jenkins is. And the Blue Jays, I mean, they tipped their hand. They had so many chances to promote him this year and they didn't do it.
Yeah. Bo Schultz, Ryan Tepera.
And those guys, I think Schultz and Tepera, sorry to cut you off, I think those guys can be useful this year.
Yeah. Yeah, guys who throw hard, you know, and you know, guys who, I don't know if they're your high leverage guys, but you know, Liam Hendricks wasn't really a high leverage guy in Toronto either. Like, he was used mostly medium to low leverage and he looked great.
Right. And you need middle relievers who are going to be effective, because like you said before, these starters don't go deep into games and this offense can come back on people. So you want guys who can just hold the fort for a little while, a couple innings, and then maybe the offense comes and, you know, Encarnacion, it's a 3-run homer and you're back in it.
Right. Pat Van Diet, another guy that we forget the Blue Jays have.
Ambidextrous.
It could be a big part of that. Like, I say today he's probably a part of the bullpen.
I wonder. He'd be in the mix anyway. I mean, he'll arrive to spring training with a chance to open some eyes.
Pretty good chance. And he was all right for Oakland last year when he came up. I mean, he had his struggles, but I mean, he was, you know, what, he got into 26 games. Like, he pitched a ton last year.
Let's hope he, that would be very cool to see.
It's going to be fascinating.
Yeah.
Regardless. All right. Let's get out of here. We got to make room for our guest. Pittsburgh Pirates pitching coach Ray Searidge is going to join us after the break on ATL.
Half steps back, the 0-2 pitch. Strike three call. And Carpenter, not too happy. Yeah, certainly. 2-2, he struck him out. 13 in a row, set down for J-Hap.
It continues on At the Letters. Very pleased to be joined by Pittsburgh Pirates pitching coach and a man with a beer named after him in Pennsylvania, Uncle Ray Searidge's Bucko Blonde Ale. It's Ray Searidge. How are you, Ray?
All right, how you guys doing? Thanks for having me on.
It's a life goal to have a beer named after myself someday, I'll tell you that. You probably don't have to pay for one of those whenever you have one, eh?
This was not in my wildest dreams having this done.
So we obviously wanted to have you on to talk about Jay Happ, who just signed with the Blue Jays. He had such a great finish to a season last year with you guys, and a lot of that success was attributed to the work that you did with him when it came to, you know, tweaking his mechanics and his approach. Can you just kind of detail what you saw from Jay when he first arrived in Pittsburgh, and you know, what some of the adjustments were that you wanted to make?
Yeah, you know, they were basic and simple. I think he got away from himself a little bit. It wasn't something that came out of the blue. This guy is very, very talented, and I think he's going to do well with the Blue Jays, especially with Russell Martin, because Russell will be able to get a good feel for him. What he did was his direction towards home plate. He was coming around his pitches as opposed to going right to the strike zone and finishing it through the strike zone. And that, you know, that, and staying over his backside. Those two things are the main things that I saw when he got there. And usually when that happens, you know, you lose yourself, somewhere, or you try to do something to compensate, a little fatigue going on or whatever the case may be. But those are the two things. And he was able to pick them up. He got back to where he normally is. And then he just started throwing up some numbers, man. A lot of donuts. He was chucking out there, and he did a real good job.
Yeah, he sure did. And having seen him, I'm wondering what, in your opinion, makes Happ really effective when he's at his best. Because you guys, arguably, I mean, that was maybe the most successful stretch of Happ's career.
You know, he had angle to all his pitches, so they're able to only see the top part of the ball majority of the time. his cutter worked better downhill, and then he was able to throw to both sides of the plate with more consistency. His curveball was more like an off-speed pitch. The changeup played really well, and then the two-seamer and the four-seamer. He, you know, he has a plan. He is a smart kid, so it wasn't really too many things that I had to teach him out there in the game. He knows how to pitch, and he's a competitor, and when he's out there, he competes, and those things helped him out to feel and to be more consistent with execution of his pitches, and that was the big turnaround for him. And then, you know, how success breeds confidence, breeds success, breeds confidence. Well, that wheel started rolling, and he was one of our most consistent pitchers.
You mentioned that cutter, and it seemed like he really relied on that as his kind of primary secondary pitch instead of, you know, he had used the two-seamer a lot in the past. It seemed like he backed away from that, and he just threw so many fastballs with Pittsburgh. I mean, was that something you guys talked about? Was that by design?
It kind of really evolved into itself as the game went along. He was, you know, when we went over a game plan, he was able to get his X's and O's, and he made adjustments when it needed to be during the game, especially with him and Cervelli and Stewart. You know, they really had a great relationship in that short amount of time. These guys were really on the same page, and they got a real good feel for him. And that cutter, it when it had angle and when he wanted to elevate it into a righty, it really worked well. And so those kind of pitches and execution of him, he was so consistent. It was really, you know, he's a mild-mannered guy when he's not on the field, but when he's between those white lines, he is a fierce competitor.
For sure. And one of the reasons that he was able to succeed this past season, and particularly with you guys, was that he cut down on his walks pretty successfully, especially considering when he entered the league I think it was around 2007, 2008, he was walking a lot of guys. And that's something that you've been able to do with pitchers like Francisco Liriano, with Edinson Volquez to some extent as well. So how do you help a pitcher cut down on a walk rate? That seems, you know, it can't be an easy thing to do because most guys don't pull that off.
No, one of the biggest things that our philosophy is in our pitching is that first pitch strikes are very important. Getting ahead of the hitter, that, you know, that first pitch strike, you know, you got the hitter at a disadvantage right off the start. And then after that, try to make something happen in three pitches or less. You know, be aggressive to the strike zone, get ahead, and then let's go to work. And then when you get ahead, then stay ahead, and then put them away. And we're aggressive mentality that way. And everybody in the league, you know, already in the National League knows that we're coming in at first pitch strikes. It might be a curveball, might be a changeup, might be a fastball, might be a two-seamer, whatever the case may be. But I ask my pitchers to make sure that if they're going to throw a first pitch off-speed pitch, that it's a strike, because it's just, the numbers are unbelievable when you start off a hitter at 0-1 as opposed to the hitter getting started off at 1-0.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because, you know, with Jay Happ, he's a guy that has struggled to kind of be efficient at times and has struggled to get deep into ball games. And when you mention about making adjustments with him and, you know, getting him away from staying over his backside, being more direct to the plate, things like that, you know, ball players sometimes can be a little stubborn, maybe a little bit hesitant to make changes to what's, you know, gotten them to the big leagues. How receptive was he? Because, you know, I know that he wasn't exactly expecting to be traded. So, you know, in a new environment, being asked to make some little tweaks, I mean, how open was he to making those changes?
They were, you know, he had them in him, but he wasn't doing them. So he was very receptive to him. You know, you know, he kind of like, oh, geez, I wasn't doing that. And I wasn't doing that either. And then all of a sudden, after those two, it's like a domino effect. You take care of one, and then two gets taken care of, and then you might need a little tweaking on number three, which is his front side, his front elbow. And obviously, when you're not going directly towards home plate, you kind of come around to the strike zone, so his front side was also flying out. So when he stayed on his backside and when he went towards the strike zone, no matter where it was, whether it was arm side or glove side, the front side stayed in to help him go and keep that direction to the execution of the pitch. And those three things right there, boom, all of a sudden he's executing pitches. He's got a real good feel for his stuff. He knows where he wants to put the ball, and it made it that much easier for him. It's not that I was, you know, I had this magic fairy dust and I sprinkled it on him. He had these things in him, and he was very receptive to them because this is what he has done in the past. Maybe now that he's a little bit more experienced and he's a little bit more open to that, that it clicked a lot quicker, and it only took one pen. And then after that, it was lights out.
Yeah, it's an amazing, amazing transformation. And he's going to try to sustain and build on that success in a park that's a tough one for a lot of pitchers to pitch in. When you're talking to guys, and as you travel around the league in the course of the season, you're playing in a lot of different parks. Do you advise any kind of adjustments, any kind of tweaks, depending on the park you're pitching in, or do you tell pitchers stick with what you do?
A little bit of both, and I'm not trying to jump on the middle of the fence here with it. Some parks are going to dictate that we pitch inside more and to get the hitters more uncomfortable. We don't want any hitters being in there comfortable. We want to make sure that they know that we're going to pitch to both sides of the plate and make them aware of that. And I think some of the ballparks that pitchers do throw to or in are small parks. So what they do is they tendency to stay away from the inside part of the plate, and they pitch away the whole time. And then before you know it, the other team's got four or five on the board. We're not gonna change our philosophy of pitching in and being aggressive. But sometimes certain situations dictate that we go from plan A to plan B, but then we're going to be able to get back to plan A again. So there's a lot of things that are in the game that are within the game that we have to make adjustments with.
You mentioned Russ Martin earlier, obviously a guy that, you know, you're familiar with, and it seems like he's going to be in Toronto for quite a while, and he's going to catch Jay Happ, I'm sure. You know, what can a guy like that do for Jay, and what can he do for pitching staff?
I think, you know, Russell is a tremendous human being and a heck of an athlete, no doubt about it. And he's got a real good feel behind the dish for his pitchers. And I think, you know, with Happ and, you know, what he's done this year with a bunch of your pitchers during the season has been tremendous. And, you know, I didn't expect anything less from him because he's a take-charge kind of guy. And I can only foresee him helping Happ out even more.
Yeah, it makes sense for sure. When you look at part of the reason that the Pirates have been so successful pitching-wise, it's not only the starting pitching, but it's the bullpen too, and uncovering guys like Caminero and Joe Blanton, who was really, really good for you guys. What are some of the attributes that you might look for in a relief pitcher who's kind of flying under the radar, because there's so many guys who tend to get overlooked and people stumble over them time and time again, and then you guys have had success converting them. So what are some things that you might look for in a pitcher who has potential to contribute in that bullpen role?
You know, number one is the stuff, obviously. If they got the stuff, then we have to work on the mental part. 90% of pitching in the major leagues is mental anyway. You cannot have fear of failure. You stay aggressive no matter what hits the fan. You stay within your game plan. There's times, like I said, that you make changes, but they're very minimal. And our guys, majority of our pitchers, I try to take the best out of them and try to make it better. We don't try to make major mechanical adjustments to everybody. We try to keep it simple. You know, a tweak here, a tweak there. Because once you start trying to delve into that and start changing guys physically, now you're going to have a mishmash. And then the mind, you know, they're thinking about A, B, C, D, E, as opposed to A, hit the spot, execute the pitch, make the pitch, and then trust yourself, and trust your stuff. And we try to stay positive with everything. Even I want to go back to Volquez. When we got him back to his delivery, the results were not there. And we're not, in spring training, we're not result-orientated. We're looking at the process, and we try to stay with the process, and I try to stay very positive with all my pitchers, especially when Volquez was going through that, and because there'll be times out there he'd give up three or four runs in an inning, and you might think I'm crazy, but I told him, I said, Eddie, man, you're good. It's good. I see some sequences. They're really good. So it's the mental part of the game that you got to make sure that they trust you, and that takes some time to build. But if you stay positive, it makes it a lot easier.
It's interesting to, you know, hear you talk about that. And, you know, when you are getting pitchers, you're generally getting, you know, what should be close to a finished product, especially a guy that's come up through your system. Do you find that your role is almost more of, you know, managing personalities, managing the mental side of the game and helping guys through those kind of, through that adversity when they get to the majors?
Exactly. Cause you still got to learn when you're coming up too. And, you know, pitching coaches wear many hats. And we've got to be a father figure. We've got to be a psychologist, a psychiatrist. We've got to be, you know, a mechanic expert. We got so many things we have to do. But up at the major league level, it's more mental. So the stuff got them there. Now, it's, and I don't want to make this sound trite. It's easier getting to the major leagues, but it's a lot tougher to stay in the major leagues because hitters will make adjustments to you. Because now with all the media we got video out the yin-yang, you got TVs all over the stadium that, you know, they could pick up little things where you might have a tip or a tell in your delivery, and those are the things we try to stay on. And but majority of the time it's more developing the, you know, the lack of fear of failure out there that, you know, stick with the process, things will work themselves out, and you'll be here for quite some time if you trust.
And a lot of these guys who have succeeded in Pittsburgh, a lot of them having worked closely with you, say Edinson Volquez, Happ now, Blanton, they've gone on, they're hitting free agency at this point, and a lot of the time they end up leaving Pittsburgh and signing substantial contracts that they've definitely earned mm-hmm. elsewhere. So what's that challenge like for yeah. you when you arrive at spring training every single year and there's a new group of arms that you're working with and trying to get the most out of?
It's great. It's like a puzzle. You try to put the puzzle together. Whatever happens after that year that you have them, you know, if they become free agents, great for them. I am so happy for Jay. I'm so happy for Volky, you know, and if Joe Blanton gets a lucrative deal, I'll be really happy for them. But at that point in time when they're with me, they're mine. They're ours. We've got to make sure that we try to make them the best that they can be and help us get to the playoffs and be an integral part of the bullpen or the rotation.
Me and Ben were talking about kind of some of the, you know, the unheralded guys in other organizations that maybe you don't hear as much about. You know, we got a guy here, Brett Cecil, who's a great lefty reliever, and, you know, he probably doesn't get the, I don't know, the attributes that he deserves on national level. Who are some guys in the Pittsburgh organization that, you know, we should keep our eyes on? You know, who are some of these guys coming up through your organization who, you know, are going to, you know, take some big leaps forward?
You know, on in our organization?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, like, we're, like you, we're not a big TV thing. Yeah, right. Media thing. You know, we're blue-collar town. And because we're playing well, that's why we're getting more TV now. But before, the guys that really played a lot into and that people are just finally figuring out, hey, these guys are pretty good, is Tony Watson, Jared Hughes, yep. And I foresee Caminero being one of those guys in a couple of years that people are going to go, holy crap, where'd these guys come from? You know, what is – but these guys, Tony Watson is probably one of the best left-handed relievers in all of baseball. But he's a setup guy, so he doesn't get many accolades. You know, Melanson got all the accolades, but if Melanson didn't get to the position that he was and became reliever of the year, he got there because of Jared Hughes and Tony Watson for most of the part. You know, there was other guys that helped along the way, but on a more consistent thing, those two guys right there really were so important for this team to win and to help Melanson get to where he was, not taking anything away from Mark. Mark is a top reliever, I'm telling you. But these guys came in, and majority of the time, you know, they're coming in with runners on and stuff, and they hold the game where it is so Mark can close it.
In the rotation, you guys have arguably two aces because Gerrit Cole, of course, Cy Young candidate, had just a tremendous season. And Francisco Liriano was really a top line starter as well. But I wanted to ask, because it's been a topic of debate around here in recent weeks, do you think that for a pitching staff to really deliver a team to the postseason, do you think that an ace is a requirement? Do you think it's a luxury? Where do you stand on the topic of whether a team needs an ace starting pitcher?
you know, that the term ace has been thrown around, but when I look at the five guys in my rotation, they're all aces. That's the way I treat them, because on that given day, he is the ace that he's pitching that day.
Right.
And to make it one guy is the main guy, yeah, I don't agree with that. I believe it's a collection of all of them, including the bullpen. But the rotation, if you have five solid guys, oh gosh, that's a pitching coach's dream, you know. But if you have the main three, and those three guys are consistent and keep the team in the game and go as deep and as far as they possibly can in that game, you know, they're the aces. They're the guys, if you want to term, you know, use that term, they're the aces. And on that day, that given day that they pitch, that he's my ace. If it's Liriano, he's the ace for that day. If it's Cole, he's that ace for that day, and so on as we go forward. It's I try not to put too much pressure on one guy. It's collective. It's a team effort, and that's one of the things we really try to enforce.
Something we've also been talking a lot about in Toronto is the importance of kind of those depth guys, those depth starters, you know, kind of at Triple A, who could step in and, you know, either make a spot start or make a run of four or five starts if one of the starters goes down, somebody gets hurt, you know, whatever the situation is. I mean, how important is that, those depth starters? And for you, I mean, what's kind of the challenge of, you know, managing guys who, you know, are coming up from AAA and, you know, that are entering into your system, and, you know, it's just getting to know them and you know, working with guys that maybe you're not that familiar with?
Yeah, well, we have that opportunity during spring training, you know, because we'll put them out there and we'll get to know them a little bit about their personalities and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, that makes it, when they come up later on, a lot easier, because they know our style. They know what we expect. And they also watch a lot of games, and also the other pitchers help them make the adjustment for that spot start. But every team, and I think it was 2 years ago, where we used maybe about three or four spot starters, because a couple of guys went down with not serious injuries, but, you know, some things that we needed to bump them from one start or give them a blow, and, you know, during the season, because the innings were adding up. And those guys, those spot starters, are so important for the whole structure of the organization. And, you know, because one of those spot starters might be in the rotation the following year. And for them to get some needed time and seasoning in a spot start and find out what it's all about up there, it's really, really good for them. And it's good for us. So the more the merrier. And we try to keep it simple when they come up. We go, hey, listen, kid, give us five or six innings, keep the team in the game. You've done your job. So we don't try to put too much pressure on them too, and in that type of situation.
Ray, we appreciate you taking this time to talk to us from Nevada. Thank you so much. And, you know, I think Blue Jays fans are going to appreciate it if you and Jay Happ discovered something at the end of last year.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. And I wish you guys a lot of luck. We'll see you during spring training, maybe.
Royals have the Blue Jays 2-1. Revere in left, Pilar in center, and Bautista in right. Wind's blowing across the top of this park, right to left. The 1-2 pitch, fly ball left field deep. Backcourt goes Ben Revere, still going back at the fence, jumps, and he makes a spectacular backhanded catch over the fence.
Our thanks to Ray Searidge for coming on and you know, having a very, very interesting conversation about J-Hab, about the Pittsburgh Pirates, about pitching coaching in general. Ray Searidge, widely regarded as one of the best pitching coaches in the majors, kind of a guru when it comes to, you know, taking unremarkable starters, relievers, anybody who throws a ball, and they kind of come into his orbit, and all of a sudden, you know, they improve their ERAs by like a run.
It's fun talking pitching with him. He has a lot of really good insights, and I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise. But he also articulates them well, and he's, you know, he seems like the kind of guy that you would want to talk pitching with. Even if you're a pitcher, you'd want to get his insights.
Absolutely. You know, he's a guy who had 7 years in the majors, 254 games with the Mets, Brewers, White Sox, and Dodgers. Has been pitching coach with the Pirates for the last 5 years. Widely attributed with helping, you know, Jay Happ figure some things out. And, you know, you could see him being kind of humble about it and being like, ah, no, we didn't do that much. It was in him the whole time. It's interesting if, you know, these little tweaks were in Jay Happ through the whole time, through his time in Seattle, through his time in Toronto and all that, but yet they hadn't been identified, or they hadn't, you know, they hadn't been brought out in him, or someone hadn't figured out how to get through to him to get him to, you know, pitch in a way that allows him to be better and have more command and limit his walks and have more velocity and this and that. It's interesting that Ray Searidge is the guy who, you know, I think there's something to that, being able to get that out of a guy that had it in him the whole time.
And it sounds like that's, that fits within a broader pattern for what he tries to do, where it's not, you know, completely rebuilding someone's delivery, but it's more likely to be some kind of, you know, change in pitch usage or change in approach, even just the mental side of, okay, we're going to attack hitters and try to get an out within three pitches. That can be a big game changer for guys who maybe have danced around the strike zone before.
Make something happen in three pitches or less. That's my, like, that's a life philosophy. Forget pitching. Like, yeah. Make something happen in three pitches or less. Like, that's a great, I love that.
Yeah. No, it's awesome. It definitely, you can see why his words resonate with pitchers too.
Yeah, absolutely. You can see he speaks how he speaks to them. And like that makes so much sense to me. Why, like, don't nibble, don't dilly-dally, like, don't mess around and, you know, try and, like, you know, cut little corners. Like, go after guys. Trust your stuff. You got you here. You clearly have good stuff. You're in the major leagues. Like, you're clearly good at this.
Here's another weird thing about Happ is, like, he is a pitcher who has the enviable combination of walk rate declining over the course of his career and velocity oddly increasing. Mm-hmm. When he came into the league, he was throwing around 88, and now he throws around 92.
And it increased in Pittsburgh by a mile per hour when he, you know, started coming over the top more and raised his arm slot. That gave him a bit more velocity as well. He's able to get a bit more spin on the ball. And his fastball's got a bit of late life that I think surprises some hitters.
Yeah, he was up over 92 with the Pirates.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's, you know, things are trending in the right direction for Jay Happ. I know it's not the sexiest signing, and I know it's not David Price, and it's not what fans wanted, but, you know, if Jay Happ's able to, I don't see, you know, I think that there's no reason why he couldn't continue the success that he had. It's going to be very much up to him, you know, to maintain adjustments and to keep, you know, executing, you know, in the proper way that allows him to get the most out of his pitches. But 5-pitch guy with velocity, off-speed stuff if he needs it. You know, Ray was talking about the changeup being a good pitch. You know, he's got the cutter. He's got the two-seamer. I mean, he's got a curveball that he can throw for strikes, apparently. I mean, what more do you want?
Yeah, it's true. Over-under 4 ERA next year.
Jeez, because that is the perfect place to put it. I don't know. I'll take under.
Yeah, I'd take under by a bit.
Take under. Like 3.85.
Yeah.
You know, 3.9. I think the biggest thing, like, I think what you really want to see out of Jay Happ is, like, a starts over 30. That's what you want to see out of Jay Happ. Is you want to see him, like, making 32, 33, 34 starts. You want starts over 30 and innings over 180.
Yeah.
That's what you want.
His career high, I think he did set a career high in innings last year. I think that was around 170. I'll look it up right here.
And there was a handful of starts with the Mariners where he only went like 3 innings or 4 innings. And that's been the big thing. And that's what I kind of remember the most about him. Not to make this the J-Hat podcast, but that's kind of what I remember the most about him from his time in Toronto was that he was, you know, he had like 85 pitches in the fourth.
Right. 172, career high.
172, over under 180 innings for J-Hat next year.
I'll take the under.
Really? I'm going to take the over.
Wow.
Yeah.
We said it here first.
Yeah.
The first of many over-unders that will be wrong. So it's 2016 Blue Jays.
That's the great thing about this game is one of us will be wrong. So, hey, let's talk about the non-tender deadline, which is going to be 12 a.m. Thursday. So midnight Wednesday. Wednesday going into Thursday, Blue Jays have a number of decisions to make. I think that their biggest decisions are probably in the outfield with Ben Revere and Michael Saunders. And what they're going to do there, whether, you know, Ben Revere is going to be quite expensive. Michael Saunders, not as expensive, but also perhaps not as reliable as Ben Revere. At least Ben Revere, you know, is going to be on the field. Michael Saunders, pretty decorated injury history. You know, how do you see this all shaking out, this outfielder logjam on the Toronto Blue Jays?
I could see it going a number of different ways, but I think this is one of the periods of time when the Blue Jays could look at making a move. You know, if you're looking to, say, non-tender Saunders, trade Revere, there are a couple different ways they could go here. And, you know, I think that Revere, he's projected to make $6.5 or $7 million. I think he's worth that. I mean, he's someone who's steadily been one or two win player in the course of his career. So I think that even though he's, you know, he's got some issues as far as power, he's never going to be a power guy, he's never going to have a great throwing arm, but he's still a useful player. So I think that he would have some amount of trade value. At the same time, though, Do you want to count on Saunders? Because if you're not entirely comfortable there and the Blue Jays are in the process of reviewing medicals on Saunders or have been leading up to the non-tender deadline, if they don't like what they see, they could cut him loose and roll with Revere and have Pompey around as your fourth.
I agree that Ben Revere is worth that money. I don't know if that's how I want to disperse my resources if I'm the Toronto Blue Jays and if I'm working with a $140 million right. payroll or something like that. I don't know if I really want to spend $7 million on a left fielder who's going to, not really get on base a ton, right? Who's just going to be okay and, defensively has his issues, has a lot of speed and he'll get a ton of hits and all that. But, I don't know if I want to spend $7 million there when I could get, a really good utility infielder or, I could upgrade a backup catcher. I could spend that money on a reliever. That's, yep. That's where I'd rather kind of use those resources when you have Michael Saunders in-house, who's only going to cost you $2.5 million. Dalton Pompey is only going to cost you $500,000. I mean, that makes a lot more sense to me.
And there's one scenario, and who knows? They could go in a lot of different directions here. So it's pretty open. But there's one scenario where you get two relievers for Revere. The first one by potentially trading them for someone, right. And the second reliever with the $6-7 million. I mean, that's kind of the perfect amount if you're signing a reliever in free agency.
Yeah,
that's the amount where you can get an established guy. You can get a legit free agent if you're willing to spend $6 or $7 million.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Doing that's how, and I think that you would get more value in the aggregate by doing that because while, maybe Michael Saunders and, Dalton Pompey can bring the speed of Ben Revere, Michael Saunders cannot, but you're not really losing much in terms of defensively in the outfield with Michael Saunders and arguably Dalton Pompey, you're going to get more pop out of the bat. I think that I would much rather go with one of those two guys in left field, take that money, get a couple relievers.
Yeah. And I think ultimately it's a good problem to have because either you end up with Revere, who I think we agree is a useful player. And beyond that, you can convert that into some pitching.
Another guy, Josh Tolley, who, as of today is probably your backup catcher for the Toronto Blue Jays. Do you think there's maybe something the Blue Jays could do with him before the deadline?
I think so. He projects at 1.8 via MLB trade rumors. So that's a fair chunk of money. I mean, you look around the game, Brian Peña, Alex Avila, the free agent catchers out there aren't signing for much more than that. And these are guys with track records of production offensively that exceed what Tolley has done. So I think that there's some chance you could see a pretender deal between Tolley and the Blue Jays. That's speculation on my part, but if I'm the Blue Jays, that's exactly what I would look to do.
Some other guys, Josh Donaldson's obviously going to be tendered a contract. Drew Hutchison, I would imagine, will be tendered a contract.
He should be.
Should be. Justin Smoke, probably tendered a contract.
I would say probably.
Yeah, probably.
I don't know if it's 100%, but, yeah. The Blue Jays don't...
There's depth there.
There is, you have Colabello, and I think we've seen that Colabello is going to be a big part of what the Blue Jays do at first base.
Yep. Brett Cecil will be tendered a contract. I think Aaron Loop will be tendered a contract.
Should be.
Steve Delabar.
I wonder.
A guy who could go either way.
Yeah, because you have the roster spot. He projects, less than $1 million, but, I guess it depends on what you think of his ability to throw strikes. If you think that he's going to keep walking guys at the rate that he has during some of the down periods in his career, then really he's not necessarily worth a guaranteed deal in a roster spot. If you think that he can command the zone the way he did in 2013, then absolutely he's worth a flyer at less than $1 million.
I feel like the Blue Jays kind of, they made it pretty clear how they feel about Steve Delabar last year. I think they made it pretty clear.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a lot of faith there. I don't think there's a lot of belief.
Right. I mean, they had chances to add him to the bullpen and he didn't end up pitching that many innings.
No, he did not. As I pull up his Buffalo stats, he was great in Buffalo last season. 24 appearances, 1.42 ERA. That's
walk
pretty
rate.
Good. Sorry?
What was the walk rate?
The walk rate was 10 walks in 25 and a third innings. So 3.6 per nine, which is okay.
Yeah.
Higher than you would like it to be.
Yeah.
But it's okay. But the strikeouts were 10.7 per nine. Great. Yeah. But it's AAA. Right? I mean, you got to do it in the majors. And when he did pitch for the Blue Jays in the big leagues, it didn't look very good. 12, he made 31 appearances for the Blue Jays last year. Where was I?
Yeah.
Steve Delabar got into 31 games last year. How did that happen? 31 games, 5.22 ERA, walk rate of 4.3, strikeout rate per nine of 9.2.
Borderline. Those are the kind of numbers you see get claimed on waivers. You know, so they're claimed. Someone wants them for a 40-man spot. But yeah, I think he's a borderline case.
But he is so cheap, less than $1 million.
Sure.
So if you are going to get, you know, something out of him,
yeah,
and he probably still has options. I would imagine
he's out of options.
Is he?
But like with all of these guys, it comes down to your evaluation of them as a player. If you think Steve Dalibar is a useful player, it doesn't really matter what he's making. He's worth whatever he's getting paid through arbitration.
And you're probably not too concerned about him being claimed on waivers if you have to send him out at the end of spring. If you lose him, you lose him.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't, you know.
You have to live with that. That's fine.
Yeah. I don't think, you know, Steve Dalibar was like found money to this organization, really. You know, and, you know, he had an all-star season with the Blue Jays in 2013. I mean, like, you know, he was great when he came over.
Traded for future KBO MVP Eric Thames.
Right? Yeah. You know, you got him for a guy who ended up playing in Korea. So, you know, you've already made your value on Steve Dalibar. Is there anybody overlooked? I think we touched on everybody. Chris Colabello could be renewed, I'm pretty sure.
Yep. Yeah, so, he's not yet arbitration eligible.
Yeah, that's fine. I don't think there's anybody. Ezekiel Carrera is probably renewable, I would assume.
He's renewable. I think we covered them all.
Those are the only, those are the only guys that would stand out to me.
Your non-tender deadline podcast at the letters.
Well, this stuff is kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah. I love this stuff. Probably shouldn't, but I find that entertaining.
What's interesting is non-tenders from other organizations who suddenly become free agents. And then you kind of think, oh, interesting. Because yeah, like Ben Revere could be like that to other organizations where like, yeah, you know, we want to get like a cheapish outfielder on the free agent market. Could be waiting right now to see if Ben Revere is going to be non-tendered.
You know, a couple of Blue Jays, very prominent Blue Jays, were non-tendered. Russell Martin earlier in his career and Eddie Encarnacion.
I would think Encarnacion's been through all kinds of major league minutiae, like when he's waivers, and claims, and DFAs, and all that stuff.
You can find really good players on the non-tendered market. Really good ones.
Absolutely. Getting the wrap it up signal. Not Sam McKee, our producer, not enjoying the non-tender podcast. It's December 1st, Sam. What do you want us to talk about? Blue Jays signed Jay Happ, and I think we wringed everything we could out of that sponge.
I think so. The
Jay Happ non-tender podcast. Hey, thanks for coming along. Hey, shout out to London, Ontario, by the way. We were in London last week, Ben's hometown, doing a pitch talks. Great crowd. Lots of people coming up saying they like the podcast, they like listening to it. So shout out to everybody out there.
Yeah, it was a fun event, as all pitch talks are. And fantastic. Yeah, a lot of good feedback from our listeners. So thanks for listening.
Yeah, man. Back in London, where Ben is from, where I went to school at the University of Western Ontario, at the former Alex P. Keaton, now called the Talbot Street Whiskey House or something along those lines.
It's still the Alex.
It's still the APK, man. Absolutely. Yeah. Met former baseball coach of occasional technical producer Emil Delich. Yeah.
Yeah.
That guy came up.
It sure did. Yeah.
Met like a ton of interesting characters in London. So shout out London, Ontario. Thank you for the hospitality. And thank you for coming along on ATL for our producer, Sam McKee, at Sam_Alton_McKee on Twitter. For Ben Nicholson-Smith, at B. Nicholson-Smith. Read him on sportsnet.ca. Lots of great content coming up, I'm sure.
Yes, definitely. I mean, really, it doesn't stop, especially there are going to be trades this week. I don't know if the Blue Jays are going to make them. We're going to see moves.
Right. So, yeah, go to sportsnet.ca. Follow Ben on Twitter for all that stuff. I'm at Arden Zwelling on Twitter. I'm like a hockey and basketball guy now. So
Get out of here. For now. Yeah.
I'll be back. But yeah, you're not going to get much non-tender speculation on my Twitter account. But you might get some other stuff that you like. Who knows? But thanks for coming along in ATL.
It's been a good one. It's been a good one.
For Sam, for Ben, for myself, Arden Zwelling, thank you so much. This has been At the Letters.